Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining me here on Cinephiles Radio. For some reason, our radio station is having technical difficulties, so we're not getting any... Oh, there you go. Music sound. Ah, everything is well. Well, slip me out there for a second, I'll be honest with you. It is live radio. I did get here in enough time. Anyways, let's get back to business at hand. We got the great Ryan T. Husk today. He's joining us with some favorable stories about some sci-fi geekhood. He's speaking to David Haverty. David Haverty put together a werewolf musical. I really want to talk to him about that. And that's original. How was your week like? You hear about all the great news that came out recently? Oh no, just bad news, right? So it has been a pretty weird week of some pretty weird to awful news. We've gone down to brass tacks. Robin Williams passed away recently. I never talked about that. And here's the interesting thing about Robin Williams passing away, and I did want to talk about that today. I usually like to stay very, very positive, but I would like to talk about this a little bit. I was talking to somebody very recently about Robin Williams dying, and their opinion immediately was that Robin Williams is weak. No, this is what he contributed. No, this is what he was like as a human being. No, this is what he was like as an actor. This was like as a person, this was like as a philanthropist, none of that stuff. Just, he's weak. If you can quantify a position so cleanly, then God bless you, you're awesome. But I'm certainly not that confident in the way this universe works that's the case, especially when you see how much Robin Williams has added to the universe compared to other people. You know, we're not trying to compare people to people, but in all seriousness, when you put Robin Williams in a room full of 10 other people, you see how much he's contributed to the universe. That's an incredible amount. And to say the man is weak, after all he's contributed to the universe, to the world, is it's pretty cut and dry, pretty ignorant. Suicide is a tough subject. I don't have the answer for it. I don't. But I got to say that it doesn't necessarily come out of weakness. I would say it's a lack of light, maybe. I don't want to guess. It's not my position. It was a horrible thing. It was a horrible thing. But the nice thing that came out of it was very interesting. I was watching House, and I think it was the sixth season. And they asked him, you know, what inspired you to be a doctor? And he said, Patch Adams. And that's from 2007. And maybe a day later, I watched a Family Guy episode where whoever Peter Griffin touched turned into Robin Williams. And it just reminds me so much how much Robin Williams has affected pop culture. In World of Warcraft recently, they put little Easter eggs along the world of World of Warcraft, in honor of Robin Williams. I'll just give you one. One was an egg split in half. It was really nice. It showed a little home, a little couch, a lamp. It was really sweet. The Mork and Mindy days. So Robin Williams dying was a huge blow, I would say, to the comedic world. Because he was a giant. He was a legend. He's done more comedically, more acting, more philanthropy than maybe 90 comedians combined into one. And I don't think I'd be having any arguments on that one. But I'm happy. On the slap side, I'm happy. Because we got Robin Williams. We got him in Happy Days when he fought off with Fonzie. That was awesome. We had him in Mork and Mindy. And then we had him in everything else, you know, including the genie from Aladdin. So, in these situations, it's much better to be happy about what happened in the universe compared to what is bad. So, I'd like to give honor to Robin Williams on a day like this. On other sad news, we had Joan Rivers who just passed away. I don't know if you know much about Joan Rivers, but Joan Rivers really created the avenue for women in comedy. Before Jay Leno took over the Tonight Show, it was Joan Rivers who was penned to take over. I think in the end, the producers or the powers that be, as we call them, didn't necessarily think that a Tonight Show with a woman being the front runner would hold up. I believe she wrote down in her memoirs that it broke her heart, but it's not unexpected in a world full of snakes, as she would most likely call it. But she paved the way for her. You know, I would say every female comedian today, you know, I mean, of course, Lucille Ball and all the great comedians before that paved the way, but Joan Rivers is the one we're speaking about today. Not Shirley Temple Black, not any of the other female comedians who just destroyed this planet with comedy, which is interesting. It brings me to an interesting point that I was talking to somebody earlier, which was the English have a very interesting avenue, at least a couple of English speakers have a point of view, which is that women cannot be funny, or women are not innately funny or comedic. And one of the reasonings is that women didn't have to suffer through having to impress women, having to overcome certain boundaries of like weight, race, whatever you want to say, that they had to go through all these things. I don't think so. If that is your logic, if your logic is that men have gone through more stuff that is comedy-based, which is why they're more comedic, then that's pretty funny. Because I would say that women have had to laugh more than men have had to laugh for the past 10,000 years. I mean, can you imagine how many queens have sat there as their husbands have said the dumbest things in the universe as commandments, and she went, oh my gosh, and just laughed it off. Behind every powerful man is a woman who thinks he's an idiot. It's my favorite quote of all time. But it does remind me that, like, look at Queen Elizabeth. She needs to have a sense of humor. She doesn't have a sense of humor that England is going to fall. The UK is going to fall. The United Kingdom is going to fall. Queen Elizabeth needed to have a sense of humor, and she did. So, and also when you see the president of Australia, she's incredible. She's amazing. But she's got a sense of humor. She has to have a sense of humor. She's surrounded by men. So if she doesn't have a sense of humor, I mean, it's pretty much over for her. We're very sad to see Joan Rivers pass away. I think she would call my show atrocious or something like that. It'd be nice to get that from her. Now, on the show front, I'm still watching House. I'm watching House right now. I'm really enjoying that show a great deal. I believe that somebody said earlier that one of the problems they had with the 8 seasons of House, and by the way, that's the biggest problem we have in American television, is that we put on shows way too long. 8 seasons is way too long for a show, even for House. And it's a good show. And the problem is that 7th to 8th season, they're really trying hard to make it different. And it's very difficult to make something like that different. Is it? Yes. Do they try really hard? Yes. Is it obvious? Yes. But it's a great show. It's on Netflix right now. Give it a shot. Give it a go. First season is awesome. Don't watch it while you're eating. I've tried a couple times. It's not very good. But it's a great show. I really enjoy it. And if any of you are watching MasterChef, go Leslie. Go Team Leslie. All right. I don't want to waste any more of your time. Let's welcome the fantastic, the magnificent, the man who we didn't have enough time for last week, Ryan T. Hunt. Hello, sir. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today, Steve?
Fantastic. Well, we didn't have enough time last week to have a chat. We started getting the geekdom, and then we kind of lost track of time, and the show had to end. But I wanted to get back to you and give you a little extra time and talk a little bit about your life.
Well, first of all, I feel like I learned something listening in on the first 15 minutes. I learned about Joan Rivers that was going to be the host of The Tonight Show. I didn't know that. That was really cool.
Oh, yeah. That was fantastic. You know, one of the things about Joan Rivers, she always stepped in for, she was the one person to step in for Johnny Carson. And she was a shoe-in. Yeah, she was a shoe-in for showrunner. And then Jay Leno came in, and I really don't know an extraordinary amount about the politics, but, you know, it was a time where women showrunners were not really there at all. So she was passed up and it was given to Jay Leno. So there was a bit of animosity for a long time, and then it was let go because she just needed to continue her career. Yeah. But that's interesting.
Yeah, also,
let me ask you a question. How does that relate to you as an actor? I mean, I know how it relates to me as a writer, because I feel like I can never write for this human being ever again because they're dead. But how does it feel as a writer or as an actor when you see some of these legends pass away? Does it have a deep impact on you as a person who's creating a resume in a world that these people are important? Or is it just important because it's part of pop culture, or is it just important, period?
You know, honestly, it doesn't really affect me that much, to be honest. I mean, I feel like if it's a sudden or tragic death, like Robin Williams, for example, that's pretty sudden. But it's less tragic in the way that he was able to make his imprint on the world. He was able to make people laugh for decades. He did give us tons of memories and tons of fun. And, you know, it wasn't like an up-and-coming star that just dies and you wish that they had more time to you know, send their message out to the world. And I think I saw a quote that's very close to don't be sad because it's over, be happy that it happened. You know, and that was in reference
right.
to Robin Williams. And that's great because, yeah, I mean, honestly, I don't know how much more he had to give. He wasn't working very much. Personally, right. I wish he'd lived to be 100 years old. But I feel like we're very fortunate that it happened at all, you know. And I did see that Family Guy episode. When you were talking about that, it cracked me up. When you're watching that Family Guy episode, you're sitting there thinking like, oh, wow, that's right. He's in this too, and this and this. And they
right.
didn't run out of Robin Williams characters that were extremely recognizable, right. you know.
And they also repeating themselves after a while.
Yeah, yeah. But they knocked out a good 15 or 20 of them.
Yes, they did. That was pretty funny, you know. It's interesting. It's kind of like buying a new car, and then all of a sudden you see your car being driven by everybody in the streets. You know, Robin
yeah.
Williams passes away, and then you watch a couple of things, and you realize, oh my gosh, every show I'm watching right now is almost making a reference to this human being or to anything he's contributed to.
Yeah, and everybody has a favorite few Robin Williams performances. You know, I think mine was probably the Dead Poets Society and Aladdin. I think those were and I liked Good Morning Vietnam. I saw that when I was a kid. You know, I think those were probably my favorite characters of his, personally.
Yeah, those are great ones. Captain, My Cat, those are great ones. When I first mm-hmm. saw Dead Poets Society, I was more of a college snob, so I didn't really like it the first time. And then I saw it the second time
Ooh.
And realized you couldn't have done this even if you wanted to. So
yeah.
it was a pretty fantastic movie. Yeah, he was a great actor. I grew up with him on when I was a child, growing up in the 70s. I saw him on first time on Happy Days, playing Mork the Orc, fighting the Fonzie, and that was awesome.
Wow.
He fought the Fonzie in a invisible laser battle, and the Fonzie won. And next you know that he had his own show. He had Mork and Mindy right after that, and that was a fantastic show, and that was a huge part of like our daily lineup of watching TV. Because if you're born in the 70s, you had your Three's Company, your Mork and Mindy, and then I don't know, maybe you had one other show after that. But it mostly was Three's Company and Mork and Mindy, which was your
that's,
nighttime.
That's all we needed.
Shows.
That actually,
oh, no,
is
what?
Three's Company was my favorite, watching those reruns when I was a kid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I wanted to be Jack Tripper.
Who didn't want to be Jack Tripper? You know, it's funny. Women, you know, a lot of people don't right? Well, I would think that at least lesbians would want to be Jack Tripper. You know, it was interesting about Three's Company. The last episode of Three's Company had Lucille Ball giving a summary of the show.
That's
of
right.
Three's Company. Yeah, did you remember that?
I do remember that.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. When they introduced the second cast member, the blonde girl, the second time around, that was such an embarrassing moment in American television. I don't know if you remember that, but Jack Tripper, like,
Cindy
spills, like, ink on, yeah, Cindy spills ink on her shirt during a party, and then everything gets quiet. And then it becomes very, very awkward.
That was the third
one.
That was Terry.
That was the third one. Terry. Thank God I have you on the show. Look at that.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of...
That was a very awkward moment in American television.
Yeah, it sure was.
So tell me, you know, so we were talking about your resume last time, and your resume is sci-fi heavy. And I love this stuff because it's very difficult to get into these circles because they're very coveted. Because once you're part of these circles, you are definitely recognized. Was that a conscious effort on your hand to go after projects that were more sci-fi related, or was that just something inside your blood?
You know, and you're right, first of all, but it's definitely 50-50 for me because, you know, I am a big Star Trek fan. Some might even call me a nerd. They'd be right. But at the same time, so of course, you know, it's kind of your dream growing up to be in the thing that you liked as a kid or, you know. But at the same time, when I've gone to, like, Star Trek conventions and when I've followed their career, I've realized that the most loyal fans reside in the sci-fi community. And within that, the most loyal fans are Star Trek fans. And, you know, I would go to these conventions and I would see that there's a guy who played a character in one episode 15 years ago, and he's on stage talking about, you know, his 7.5 minutes of fame, and people are asking questions like, what are you in next? Where can we see you? What CD are you recording that I could buy? Are you writing a book that we could buy? You know, I want to get your action figure. And I'm thinking, these are the most loyal fans. God bless them. They're like, they will do any. They will follow you to the ends of the earth for the rest of your life if you are in a Star Trek episode. And so, of course,
yes,
you're thinking, "Wow, this I got to get into this group here, man. They are awesome. They're like the best fans in the world."
They are fantastic. Have you found that? Have you gone to any conventions and been recognized or anything like that yet?
I'm starting to get recognized, yes. I haven't gotten there are no current TV series for Star Trek right now. There hasn't been for,
right,
I don't know how long it's been, maybe 7 years or so. And and there are just the movies going on. And I've gotten to be in the most recent movies, but very small parts. So the people that recognize me are the ones that are watching the independent Star Trek films, or the YouTube videos I would do about the Star Trek conventions. And you know,
right,
they're always just like the nicest people, you know. So those are the people that you want to recognize you anyway. Those are the people that you want to know you because they're good people.
I very much enjoyed your YouTube channel. How can everybody else find your YouTube channel? Should they just type in your name in YouTube, or do you have a direct link to your...
Well, my personal YouTube channel would be youtube.com/TheIncredibleHusk. And the one that I did all of the videos on, you know, like the Star Trek convention videos and the travel videos and all those was youtube.com/InProvence. And so that's where I got most of the views and the viewership was from that one. But now I'm going to be focusing more on my own personal one.
Oh, what your own personal one? So, what do you have going on?
Well, I don't know.
That's
just, well, when I'm saying when I do get back into doing the YouTube stuff, I'm going to be doing it on my personal one rather than the In Provence one. As it stands right now, I've got a long queue of things I need to be editing to put up there, but I'm not sure if that's going to be happening anytime soon because I'm actually busy doing movies and shorts and such and web series.
Well, your whole IMDb is just littered with shows to movies to shows to movies. And that's a very interesting thing because maybe in the 1980s that was impossible. You'd only see either movies or TV shows. But I see Bones, Star Trek, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, and Deadliest Warrior with Sean Piccinino. So yeah, that's a really large gambit of projects there that go from different directions. How does that feel? Because I know that actors are, at least a portion of actors can be insecure because it is an insecure market to a certain extent. It's almost like being in stocks. When you go from the TV shows to the movies to the TV shows to the movies, does that ever concern you, or is that just work is a good thing and that's what I do?
Yeah, it's definitely the latter. It's kind of like, I think a friend of mine said it best, that he said, you know, I hate auditioning. The only thing I hate more than auditioning is not auditioning. And it's so true because, like, as actors, we're really just you kind of look ahead, and sometimes you might say, "Ah, this is confusing, or this is stressful, or I'm nervous for whatever it happens to be." But anything is better than not working, you know. And so you always take it with a grain of salt, and you always feel lucky when you are working on something, even if it's just in the back of your mind. You're feeling lucky that you're not just sitting on your couch or on your computer looking for auditions, you know, that you're actually working. And then so the stress of finding work is diminished because you're in the process of working, you know.
Right. Let's go back to the sci-fi world because this is very intriguing to me. So you definitely can see how the pop culture of sci-fi is very integrated into our society here. Where is the future plans leading into when you look at the sci-fi world? Are you trying to get deeper into the sci-fi community? Is that a plan of yours?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the reason the sci-fi culture is so ingrained in us right now is because, come on, we're living in the future right now. It's 2014. I mean, just the name, just saying, that sounds like the beginning of a movie right there. In the year 2014, cell phones, I don't know. But so I feel like we are living in the future. But to answer your question, I like sci-fi. Like I said, I initially was just very focused on Star Trek. I really wasn't, you know, I don't watch that much TV, so I didn't see all of these great sci-fi shows. But once I started doing these Star Trek things, I started meeting, like, other people and other sci-fi things and working in similar sci-fi projects. So now it's kind of expanding my horizons. Like I told you last week, I only just saw Battlestar Galactica for the first time a year ago. And I still haven't seen Firefly, and I know I should. And I know it's not a big commitment because it's like 13 episodes. And what are the other big ones out there? I don't think I'll ever watch Doctor Who.
That is insane to me. That is crazy to me. Are you crazy? You're driving me nuts.
Yes, I am.
I need to – you know what? You're making me want to go to your house and, like, give you the DVDs, put them in your DVD player, sit you down, and, like, cook you dinner and lunch for the next week and then you're finished. Watch the show.
Well, if you really want to do that.
It's funny about
Battlestar. I would love to eat.
Yeah. You know what's funny? I would love to do that. If you want, I love that show. What's it called? It's Portlandia. They did a skit called One More Time or One More Episode.
Yeah, I saw that one. That one's hilarious. It's so funny.
Did you see that one?
Yeah, I did.
Just one more episode, and they lose their job, they lose their house, they lose everything. And that's pretty much how the show goes.
The part that kills me is...
You know what's interesting is... Go ahead.
I was just saying the part that kills me is when Fred Armisen goes, "It's just so good."
Yes. It is good. I remember I remember Sean did not want to watch the show, and I want him to watch the show so bad. I love the show. I'm like, watch the show, watch the show. Like, no, I don't have any time. And obviously, he didn't have enough time. And then later on, they were doing Blood and Chrome, and they were casting for it, and he was going for one of the parts. And so I played a young Adama against his part.
No way.
And then he's like, I love this show. This show's incredible. I'm like, right? You should have been in the show a long time ago.
Wait, hang on a second. Young Adama?
No. When he was casting, when he was trying out for casting for the show, he needed to bounce off another person. I don't tell him I hate doing it, but he needed somebody else off the character. So I played a young Adama, so I try to use the voice, you know, a young Adama.
Mm-hmm.
going back to the sci-fi thing, you went from Star Trek, and then you worked with a couple of the cast members from Battlestar Galactica, right?
Yeah. There's an independently but professionally produced Star Trek film called Prelude to Axanar. I associate produced on that. And there were Colonel Ty. I'm sorry, Colonel Ty will be in the next one, Michael Hogan. In Prelude to Axanar, there was Kate Vernon, who will also be in the second one. She played Ellen Ty. And Richard Hatch plays our outstanding villain Klingon, and he will also be in the next one. And I'll tell you, man,
who's he going to be played by? The last character. Who'd you say he was going to be played by?
Oh, that's Richard Hatch. And Richard Hatch was the original Apollo in the original Battlestar Galactica series.
Yes.
And he is Tom Zarek in the newer one.
That's right. Oh, somebody who knows their shows. Look at that. Tom Zarek. I mean, when he came onto the show, it was a very interesting thing. Have you seen the entire show all the way through?
Yes, but let me tell you something. I just got a message from my girlfriend that says she's listening, and she's only on season 3. So let's only talk until the beginning of season 3. You know, like what you did with Sean, forcing him to watch Battlestar. That's what I'm doing with her. I'm like, you have to watch it. And one of the most glorious moments in my life was sometime at the beginning of season 2 was when we were watching it. You know, I was like holding her head, forcing her to watch this thing. And she turns to me and she's like, oh, my God, Battlestar has gotten so good. And I was like, yes.
Yes.
Score one for the nerds.
Kate Vernon is an excellent, excellent actress.
Yeah.
You know, I think she shocked a lot of people. And we won't say too much because we know what happens to her later on. But and by the way, this is not a good time for spoilers, boys and girls. This show has been out for a couple years now, so watch the show so I can talk about it. But Kate Vernon, who plays Ellen Ty, you sacrifice your existence to watch all the shows, and like, come on, guys, catch up to this, please. And you were talking about Richard Hatch as well. But anyways, Kate Vernon, who played Ellen Ty, that was brilliant. When you look at how she played the character in the first 2 seasons, you write her off, I mean, pretty much. She's
totally
a tart. She's a, you know, she's a segue to another subject matter a lot of times. She often gets them in more trouble than's necessary. And then when you see her transition, that's incredible.
Yeah. And then,
right.
And then I really liked Michael Hogan in that whole thing where he's just, you know, he's so gruff with everybody else, but he's just got this soft spot for this woman, you know, and he's just, you know, it's just like he would do anything for her at any point, no matter how horrible she was to him, you know, forever. You know, I really like that dynamic between the two of them.
Michael Hogan is incredible. I mean, I didn't necessarily like his acting in episode of Smallville right after Battlestar Galactica was over, but I loved seeing him because I love his character. You know, Colonel Ty is what you want beside you at all times if you're inside that episode or inside that world. I can't get his voice out of my brain sometimes. You fracking. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
get out of my fracking way. You fracking idiot.
Better.
I love that stuff. You know what's funny is I didn't even know frack was a word until I came to Colorado, and then I discovered that fracking rocks or fracking the ground was actually a subject matter. Really?
Yeah.
I thought that was the I thought that was the excuse for the F word in Battlestar Galactica.
Well, I'm pretty sure. That it's unrelated. I would guess that it's maybe unrelated. Maybe they were just coming up with something, you know, as like a euphemism or, you know, a way to cuss without cussing, you know, like how they say gods God, singular.
Well, I thought the show was a piece of genius. If you see the frontrunner created, like, you know, Voyager, Deep Space Six. When you see the world that he created, that essentially what you're watching are aliens trying to find us. That's an incredible show. And I like, the people I know why I watch the show continually. I like to watch the show at least 3 or 4 times a year. And one of the reasons why, it's very much like Lost to me, where the beginning, the middle, and the ending show you a progress of character analyzation. It goes into the scientific, it goes into the religious, it goes into the biological, it goes into all the different perspectives of sci-fi, and really captivates your imagination. It doesn't give you the answers in the end, but you don't want the answers. And very much like, you know, like nude photos, not to bring in any weird subjects up, but, you know, you don't really want certain things, even though you want certain things. So the answers at the end of Battlestar Galactica, to me, were perfect. So how did you feel about the ending without spoiling it for your wife?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, now the reason I watched Battlestar was because all of my most trusted nerd friends, you know, like the ones that really like Star Trek like myself, you know, and they said, you got to watch BSG, right. You got to watch Battlestar, so finally I just gave in, I trusted them. That being said, those same people were the ones that said, hey, you know, when you're done watching it, tell me what you think about the ending, because the ending was pretty controversial in a lot of people's minds. A lot of people were very, very dissatisfied with the ending, or they didn't like it, or they thought it was ridiculous, and others thought that it was it was perfectly packaged and neatly tied up in a bow. For me, I would say that I was about 70% that I thought it was great, you know, maybe 80% where I was just like, yep, perfect little ending, everything's great. Awesome. Cool idea. Never thought of it before. Terrific. But there was a couple aspects without getting into details. I was like, what? That doesn't make sense, you know?
Right.
But other than that, I was more on the side of the people that enjoyed the ending, that thought it was a good ending that leaves you, you know, it gives you kind of a full circle and it completes it. You know, it packages it nicely and says, here's 4 seasons of our show, you know. Although I did think it kind of went on almost a half a season too long. I feel like that half of the second half of the 4th season kind of, I felt like they were running out of ideas and they were just trying to top themselves.
It was getting a little apocalyptic. And when things get a little apocalyptic, I know things are kind of running out of ideas. But just like Lost, like in season 2, I'm really glad they were able to get past that. And that's the difficult part of certain shows is they can't get past certain, I don't know, pit holes. When you look at a show like House, it runs 8 seasons. It's a powerhouse. So certain things you cannot change. But when you look at a thing like BSG or Firefly, they change things drastically. Or even Star Trek now when they change the timeline. Now that's changing things drastically. Right? Interesting is a lot of people have not seen... Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, and you know who hasn't seen Lost yet? This guy.
You haven't seen Lost yet? Oh,
no,
my gosh.
I know. I haven't seen any shows. I haven't seen any of them, but
I can't wait to talk to you when you have seen it. It's great. You're going to love it. You're gonna watch the show, and you're going to be like, I should have been on this show.
Well, that would just make me sad.
you just pick a show just like that in the future. I mean, they'll come out with a different thing than the show. You know what's very interesting? And let's get off of Battlestar Galactica and let's go into some other subject matters. But wait, I don't know if you ever saw the webisodes, but Felix Gaeta and the webisodes was excellent. They had a couple webisodes that
I didn't see
those. They filled the gap.
That's on my list now.
please, I want to spoil something for you so bad, but I'm not going to. When you watch that web, I want to. So, I mean, trust me, I want to just smash you right now. But when you watch the episode, please let me know what you think, because I know you're going to love it. But it changes some of the perspectives of the characters, and one in particular is Felix Gaeta, Alessandro Giuliani. If you look at his character and what his character really was like behind closed doors, he was different. He was different as a human being. It was quite amazing. So watch the episodes. Everybody out there, I see we have a nice audience out there today. Thank you very much for listening today. Watch the episodes of Battlestar Galactica. Okay, Ryan.
Yeah,
I'm
looking it up right now. It's called Battlestar Galactica, The Resistance, correct?
And yes, there's two sets of episodes.
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah, I will check that out.
Yeah, they'll be on IMDb. They're on IMDb. They're on YouTube. The first place I saw them was on IMDb.
Hmm.
So you'll love
it. So you have a
lot of shorts in production. Not counting Turning Tables, which is a feature, and When the Fever Breaks, which is a feature as well. So let's go back a little bit to Star Trek Renegades. So Star Trek Renegades, what can we expect from this?
Now Renegades, this is a different one. This is not the one with the Battlestar Galactica actors.
Right.
This is Star Trek Renegades is a movie. It's got a lot. Actually, it does have one Battlestar Galactica actor from the original Battlestar, which was the original Boomer, Herb.
Oh, yes.
What is his name? I can't remember. But anyway, he was the original Boomer.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Really nice guy, yeah. Really friendly fellow. So that's one Battlestar connection. Herbert Jefferson is his name. Now, we also have we also have Edward Furlong in there. From Terminator.
Yes.
We've got Gary Graham from Star Trek and from Alien Nation, and a bunch of other Star Trek actors, including Walter Koenig, who played Chekhov in the original series of Star Trek.
So that is awesome.
What Renegades is it basically takes place a little bit beyond the final series of Star Trek that we've seen, which was Voyager. And it's got a few characters reprising their roles, like Tuvok from Voyager and Icheb from Voyager and Chekhov from the original series. And it's kind of like a mystery, you know, one of those whodunit, but at the same time there's a lot of action. It's a political thriller kind of thing where so the very fabric of the Federation is being torn apart or undermined from the inside, you know, so it's kind of a spy thriller, thing like that.
Right.
They're currently working on post-production, and I don't know exactly when it'll be done, but I would assume sometime at the beginning of next year.
That's insane. I mean, considering that a lot of us are Trekkies, and a lot of us are, I mean, and Star Wars fans, I don't care what anybody says. If you like Star Wars, you like Star Trek. Star Trek Renegades, that sounds incredible. Why have we not heard about this this great TV movie being made? And what can we do to actually bring attention to this project?
Well, you know, I think the reason you hadn't really heard about the Community is that it's coming up now. Now it's blowing up. But honestly, I didn't know about any of this stuff till maybe a year and a half ago was when I first started finding out that there are people out there trying to produce Star Trek things, and so it's crowdfunded. So one of the things I realized when I was trying to, you know, get the word out there for Axanar, the one with the Battlestar Galactica actors and Star Trek actors, now that's totally professionally produced. It's completely, you know, produced by professionals in the industry, but we still need to raise the money to get it done. And what I realized when I was looking, you know, for ways to promote is that hardly anybody knows about it because it's not mainstream. So that is the biggest task for us, is reaching the people, because most of the people, once find out about it, they say, yeah, I would love to donate, you know, $5 or $10 or $20 to see a new Star Trek thing. I've been dying to see new Star Trek stuff or a new Star Trek series.
Right.
And a lot of the people, once the crowdfunding campaign is over, the worst thing I hear is when people say, oh, man, I totally would have donated to that, but it's over already, you know. So that is the biggest challenge, is reaching the people, is
right.
Getting, because they're, even if only 1% of Star Trek fans would donate their time and money into something like that, well, what is there, like 100 million Star Trek fans out there at least? That 1% of that is still a million, you know. So
right.
So that is the biggest challenge. But it is definitely growing, and people are becoming more and more aware of it.
You know, that is one of my problems about the Star Trek property itself. When I love J.J. Abrams, but when he took over the Star Trek movie, they made a deal that they would not make another TV series until he was finished with 1, 2, or 3 of the Star Trek films. And that was written
Correct.
Into his contract when he wrote and directed those films. That's a good thing on one hand, because it doesn't mess up the timeline or go into his world and you can restart Star Trek in a nice way, all that stuff. On the other hand, people think that the show itself is dead or cannot be revived, which is completely false.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the sad part about that is that there's a good chance there might be a fourth movie, and so we might not be seeing a Star Trek series until 2020. That's just, now,
that's
for the people in your audience that don't care about Star Trek, they're saying, yeah, so what? But, I mean,
the people in my audience care. That's why they want to listen to you talk. They care about Star Trek, and they want to see more Star Trek stuff, including myself, because I grew up with Star Trek. As a writer, Star Trek, Twilight Zone, these two shows based on quantum physics, quantum mechanics, these shows are the ones that give you a litany of ideas as a writer that things are boundless. Things are bound. You don't have to fit within the lines. You can go outside the lines and still make an excellent show or an excellent story. The Twilight Zone and Star Trek were those great shows. It's sad to see that happening. But you even after Renegades, you have another thing going on. You have Star Trek Horizon, where you play an admiral, right?
Yeah.
And that's filming right now.
Yeah. I'll tell you one quick piece of trivia for you that I just realized is going back to Star Trek Renegades for a second is. We shot Star Trek Renegades in the same studio that shot Firefly. So we got to actually shoot some scenes inside, what was the ship's name? Serenity or something like that?
Yes.
We got to shoot in Firefly. We got to shoot some of the scenes inside the ship, you know, from Firefly, which was a lot of fun for most people.
Really?
I'd never seen it before, yeah. Yeah, it's still
and
around.
You've never seen, ladies and gentlemen, go to Ryan T. Husk's Facebook page and message him to watch Firefly, considering the fact it's only 8 hours of sci-fi show. You'll never regret it. You know, you're like my friend in high school who wouldn't eat a Twinkie. It just drove me nuts. I'm like, eat the damn Twinkie. I won't eat the Twinkie. Eat the Twinkie. It's just a Twinkie. You're going to love Firefly. If you,
I hope there's a happy ending. I hope he ended up eating the Twinkie and saying, "You're right, it was delicious."
He never ate the Twinkie, but he is.
You know, nobody can talk about a Twinkie without me thinking of Ghostbusters.
Right? You know, it's funny,
but yeah.
You know, we're gonna think of Ghostbusters in the future. They're gonna think of Zombieland.
Yeah. Or
because in Zombieland, he was searching for a Twinkie throughout the entire movie.
That's true. I'd forgotten about that. That's really – I remember that. I really liked that movie, honestly, Zombieland.
Yeah.
I thought that was really good. But going back to your original question about Star Trek Horizon, yeah, I'm playing a Romulan admiral. So that was really fun because who doesn't love playing aliens? I mean, you get alien makeup put on you, and you can now become something completely different. And it helps you to be to get into a different character when you're looking at yourself in prosthetics.
Right.
By the way, Tim Vitito and Lisa Hansel did the makeup and the sculpting for the ears and the forehead piece for me on Star Trek Horizon, and they are really good. They do a lot of sci-fi makeup and effects props and prosthetics. They have a company called Impact FX, so you can check that out, or you can just go on IMDb and look at the credits, and you'll see who's doing that. But anyway, I was the Romulan admiral for a fellow named Tommy Kraft, who is doing Star Trek Horizon. And this is a kid, I swear, I think he's like 24 or 25. He lives in Detroit, and he's like some kind of computer whiz. Like, he's doing all these visual effects by himself. He's wow. Sewing all of the wardrobe by himself. He's putting together the wardrobes and all of the effects, and it looks terrific. I don't even know. When I was 24, I think I was still watching The Simpsons or something. Stupid.
Right. Wow. Well, you know, things that make you feel stupid sometimes. Well, that's incredible. So you play Admiral Varric in that. And what's interesting, because Varric is a recycled name a lot of times in the Star Trek universe. I've heard it several times.
Oh, really?
How hard was that? Yeah, I heard it on Voyager. I heard it on, I believe, on Voyager. And if my audience, if you can correct me, please, write in, call in, type in. Correct me, please. I would love to know where I'm wrong on that one. But,
you know what? If you need Star Trek correction, I'm your guy. I think you're thinking of Vorak. Vorak, I think that was, he was an ensign Vulcan on Voyager who went through Pon Farr in one episode. But yeah, all those Vulcan and Romulan names do sound very similar. There's like Vorak, Varak,
yes.
Spock, Varak, you know.
Yes, Spock does sound similar to that. Yeah, you're right. So this guy is doing everything on his own. He's doing the special effects. Is he doing the green screen, green room himself as well and all that stuff?
Yep, lots of green screen. In fact, that's how he shot me was when we were down, and he went down to San Diego at the same time I was there during Comic-Con, and I was able to bring down green screen and lighting equipment and everything we needed. He brought his awesome camera, the Black Magic camera, and we just shot my part right there.
Nice.
Yeah, so that worked out really well, so I didn't have to go all the way up to Detroit to be an alien.
How do you like that Black Magic 4K?
Oh, speaking of which, that's right. Well, I'll tell you, from what I've seen, it looks amazing, and we got to use one on on our own zombie movie, which was When the Fever Breaks. Any idea how
that's
we got
right.
all of that?
Yeah, no, I don't, actually. We have two now, you know? We needed a second one throughout filming. We have two now, yeah. The second one is on its way. We have a couple more days of filming left. But, yeah, we have a second camera on its way. I hope you like the grain. And I love that 4K.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's only the second time I've worked with one, to my knowledge. So, you know, I'm still kind of, like, looking it over and being like, it doesn't look like a camera. Are you sure? It looks like something 30s.
I know. You look at this thing, and it's literally the size of, like, an SLR. And this thing, you know, shoots The Hobbit. And those things are just incredible. So you know, we didn't get too much into this last week, but let's go into the When the Fever Breaks. So you play Dean in When the Fever Breaks. Yeah. Please tell us about your character.
Well, my character is, I feel like he's one of those challenges for an actor in that he's not very extreme. Like, for me, it's easier to portray a character that's, like, you know, crazy or, you know, really angry or really stupid or, like, the wacky neighbor or, you know, a total player, you know. But the guy that's more, like, just the good guy, the guy that you root for, it's tougher because you don't really have a real strong trait to really focus on, you know what I mean? You don't have like that crutch or that thing to focus your energy on. So Dean is, basically his story is he's kind of, you know, like a high school quarterback, you know, so, you know, he was athletic and I guess he kind of grew up or hurt himself and became like a handyman. And so now he's in his late 20s. He's got a girlfriend who, played by the lovely Genevieve Gearhart, who has a daughter. And so really he's become a family man and he's a good guy. You know, he's not too angry. He's always kind of the voice of reason. He's the guy that during a crisis is trying to calm people down is trying to gather up the troops and, you know, be like a quarterback. He's trying to say, all right, we got this. We can do this.
Right.
Let's all stick together. Let's all, you know, work out a plan, you know. But, of course, there are six other personalities.
So you die then. Every time a guy tries to figure out a plan in a zombie film, you're dead. Every time somebody is the good guy and the hero and you know this guy has a solid plan, I hope that does not happen to your character, man.
Well, I'll tell you this much.
So
I can I'll only give you this one spoiler. There are people that die in the movie. That's all I'll tell you. And who dies, well, you'll just have to wait and see.
Well, you have Chadwick Armstrong in the film and Genevieve Gearhart and yourself, mm-hmm. Ricky Husk, and then Dylan Lawrence and Cruz Malga and Sean Paul Piccinino and Violet Smith. Now, Tymaine Clay wrote and directed the film with his wife, Lucy Clay.
Yeah.
How was that working with a wife and husband team on a film?
Well, Lucy kind of, she mostly was just writer-producer, so once we started shooting, she was just kind of doing her own thing. You know, she would pass by and see how everything was doing, you know. So I think she did what sometimes we hope someone will do. Sometimes you have, like, a producer that hasn't produced before, and they just kind of are trying to impose their will a little too much or getting in the way or something like that, whereas someone like Lucy, she was brilliant enough to write this, you know, great script with Tymaine, and then just kind of said, all right, now you guys take care of it. If you need anything, let me know. You know what I mean? So she was awesome. And Tymaine is a great director to work for because he doesn't, you know, pardon the expression, he doesn't bust your balls. You know what I mean? Like, he runs a tight ship where he wants everything to run smoothly and move quickly. But as an actor, he kind of just lets you act. And, you know, he lets you do your thing, and he lets the DP do his thing, and he lets, you know, the script supervisor do his or her thing. And when he needs to be heard, he raises his voice, and he's heard. But for the most part, he just seems like more interested in the fact that he hired the right people, and he lets those right people do their jobs. And when he has a question or a suggestion or something he needs done, he just says it, but there's never any feelings hurt. There's never any frustration. You know what I mean? I mean, if you've met Tymaine, you'll know he's a really nice guy, you know?
That's awesome. Yeah, he's had a lot of high energy. It's kind of funny. You remind me a lot of Quentin Tarantino, whereas he almost breathes to take a break before he goes to the next subject matter, which is very interesting. I like listening to people like that because it always keeps your brain working. But, you know, when the fever breaks, it's a great cast. I've seen a lot of footage so far. If I were to ask you, what separates this film from the other zombie films? What's different about this movie than any other zombie film? What would you say to me?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. Well, I'm in this one. Not too, but
number
I
one.
Would say, honestly, that the writing clearly sets it apart in that it's not... I would venture to say that it's not a zombie movie in the same way that I don't believe that The Walking Dead is a zombie TV show. When I first started watching The Walking Dead again, I started late. I watched it like last year. My first thought was, this isn't a show about zombies. This is a show about two things. It's about survival and making hard decisions. You know, and that's what I think set, because if it was just a TV show about zombies, how long would it last? We've all seen zombies.
Right.
It would last like 5 episodes. So When the Fever Breaks is different in that regard, too, is that it's a show about people, or it's a movie about people and relationships and how they react in a time of crisis. And, you know, it's more of a story of people and what they're doing within their own home in this circumstance, more so than it's about zombies. Now, the zombies are there, and you're going to see some awesome zombies, and you're going to see some guts, and you're going to see everything that you want to see, but that's not what the movie's about. You know, and that's
right.
And that's really not, we don't want to see that anyway, because the fact of the matter is that we are people, we're not zombies, so we want to see who we relate to. Would I react like this guy? or would I react like her, or, oh, they made the wrong decision. I totally would have grabbed the hammer, or, oh, what is she doing walking in there? She needs to get a weapon. You know, that kind of stuff. We can't help but put ourselves in that position. So if we naturally, as humans, put ourselves in the situation that we're watching, then, you know, the least we could do is write something that is going to make those people kind of relatable so that the person can really almost feel like they're there. You know what I mean?
Right. You know, from what I saw, what was very interesting about the film, it did remind me a little bit of Cabin in the Woods, where it was more about characters and the movement, the storyline, than it was about a prop like a zombie.
Yeah, that's
and I enjoyed
right,
that a lot more than like The Walking Dead, where The Walking Dead is about, you know, eight idiots who can't make a decision, and before they know it, everybody dies because they're stupid. You know, it's so annoying. I mean, if that show was a zombie, I'd shoot it. But I liked when the fever breaks, and I liked the way the story went, and that was very interesting. You know, we're running out of time here, but I wanted to end on Star Trek, Futures Memorial. You play Lieutenant Commander Jack Crusher. So can you tell us about that?
Great.
And by the way, Crusher is definitely a recycled Star Trek name, because we all know Crusher from Star Trek Next Generation.
Aha!
Don't tell me.
Yes, you hit on something. Lieutenant Commander Jack Crusher is actually Wesley Crusher's dad and Beverly Crusher's husband.
Get out of here!
Yeah, you nailed it. Now, here's what's interesting about that is this is actually going to be a series, but first we're just doing the short film, and then we're going to do the series after. And this series takes place in the new alternate timeline. Now, in this alternate timeline, Wesley Crusher's dad does not die when Wes is like 4 years old. You know, Wesley Crusher's dad, Jack Crusher, dies on a mission that Captain Picard sent him on, and that's why Captain Picard always feels bad. He always feels bad towards Beverly and Wes, because best friend or one of his best friends was killed, you know, by an order that he gave. Now, in the alternate timeline, that didn't happen. You know, something else happened. So now we've got Jack Crusher, and he's raising Wesley Crusher. So what you've got is everybody thought Wesley Crusher was cool and that he was really smart, but they also kind of thought he was wimpy and dorky. Now, if he had a father figure in his life the whole time who was a lieutenant commander and who was a soldier and who was tough and strong and intelligent, he'd be raising this kid to be the same. So what you've got is a kid that's less wimpy and nerdy, but still a genius.
Right.
So that's kind of how that dynamic goes. And that's what the story is about. It's about the Crusher family.
That is awesome. I know that Wesley Crusher was supposed to be a nemesis and then was cut out last second because of continuity issues. And I know
that
he regretted leaving the show when he did. He left the show under not so fantastic circumstances. He wanted to do something else, and then he left with what I believe the Wanderer, right? And I love that storyline. But I really wanted to see. I mean, I really was expecting him to be the next Captain Picard or the next echelon of commanders. I was kind of heartbroken to see his character wither away.
Yeah, we thought he was going to be the next generation of officers. But one little bit of trivia for you, too. If you remember an episode of Next Generation called Yesterday's Enterprise, there was where Tasha Yar comes back and they all blow up and stuff. There's a female captain named Captain Garrett, Rachel Garrett.
Yes.
Really liked her. She was great. Captain Garrett is the captain in Star Trek Futures. She is our captain, and we are on the Enterprise C.
Get out of here.
Yeah, so that's
really
not all tied together. Yeah, so we've got a few tie-in characters from the regular
That is one
timeline.
Of the best. You know, that's one of the best storyline, regular timeline. When Tasha Yar comes back, you know, what's interesting is a lot of people don't understand the politics anymore about Star Trek or the world. Back in the old days, when Star Trek Next Generation came out, Tasha Yar, at least the actress who played Tasha Yar, she was in Playboy magazine. Actually, she posed for Playboy magazine before she was on the show.
Oh, wow.
And then when the Playboy magazine came out after season one, they fired her because she was on the magazine. And they gave her an unceremonial death by killed by a by a tar monster essentially.
Yeah,
and
so
that's
weird.
What I loved, wasn't it? I mean, this was an essential character, so it was very, very weird. So when Tasha Yar came back as being the half Romulan, half human, and also really favored the Romulan side, that was a great a fight back for women. I thought. Because I did think that there was a certain bit of an injustice going on there, because I loved Next Generation, and there was not a lot of women in the sci-fi world at the time. So to get rid of one more sci-fi woman to me was, and she had a great backstory. I don't know if you remember her backstory, but she was part of a prison planet, and she was being searched by a rape colony, and her sister didn't get away. Her sister got caught. Yeah, there's a whole backstory going on there. You're bringing out the inner geek in me big time. But yeah, I love this stuff.
So now before I go, let me just tell you a couple quick messages I got from my girlfriend while we were talking. First of all, when we were talking about when you were trying to convince me to watch Firefly, she said in all capital letters, "Yeah, let's watch it." So you at least convinced her to watch Firefly.
Yes.
And when you mentioned Cabin in the Woods, she said she loves Cabin in the Woods, and then she says, "That guy you're talking to is a total Joss Whedon fanboy." Is she right?
Joss Whedon fanboy?
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. I'm a total Joss Whedon fanboy. I've had people come on and knock Joss Whedon, and you can't say anything about it. You have to go with what people feel like. But, my thing is my writing has a lot of women characters. I write a lot about women, and one of the reasons why is I grew up with The Count of Monte Cristo and Wuthering Heights and all of these things, and you always expect a man to prevail, to win, to get the riches and get back to get the woman, to get her impregnated. He's going to live, she's going to die. The men always survive. So when you read Clan of the Cave Bear, which is one of the books that inspired me the most as a writer, as an author, I write novels, what she did was, it was a Cro-Magnon time, she was pregnant, she's not allowed to carry a weapon, She's married to the king of Java men. She picks up a weapon to protect her pregnant self against a bear. She protects herself. They kick her out of the clan. She has to go hide underneath a tree and give birth to a child. They say, if you give birth to your child and you survive, you can come back. So she goes underneath the tree. She gives birth to the child. She comes back as queen of the Java men. That, to me, is an excellent story, and that's why I loved Voyager, because you had a woman captain, and then you had a woman admiral. And I just adore those storylines. So when you look at Joss Whedon, J.J. Abrams, and people like this, they really do. And we look at James Gunn, who just did Guardians of the Galaxy, even though he did get flack for that film. They make excellent female characters.
Mm-hmm. Battlestar Galactica makes excellent, strong female characters, too. And you know who I think is a really good female character right now? It's Cersei Lannister in Game of Thrones. She's got to be my favorite female. Because even when she's
fantastic.
Even if she doesn't have one line in a scene, if she's just sitting in a room with a bunch of guys talking about cutting people's heads off, it still feels like she's the one in control. Like, all she does is she, like, lifts an eyebrow and kind of looks across the room, and it still feels like she's pulling the strings even when she's not saying anything, you know?
Right. It goes back to one of my favorite sayings, which is, behind every powerful man is a woman who thinks he's an idiot. I love that so much. The old women in the old days were called whisperers. They used to whisper in the king's ear, and they go, "I have a great idea." She had a great idea.
Yeah, that's right. Thank goodness I'm not a powerful man. Otherwise, I'd be an idiot.
Well, tell me, Ryan, I'm so happy to have you on today, and thank you for bringing out my inner geekdom. I really appreciate that. We want to reach you. All the fans are clamoring about you. How can we get in touch with you? How can we find more about you?
Well, you can just search my name, Ryan T. Husk. You can do it on Google or on IMDb or on Facebook or on MySpace. Nah, not really MySpace. But or Twitter. You just search my name and you can find me and you can connect with me there.
There's not going to be like 100 Ryan T. Husks?
No.
There's just one Ryan T. Husk?
I think when I Googled my name like 10 years ago when I was a musician, there was a Ryan Husk who was in like minor league baseball. And I was like, who is this jerk with my name? But that's why if you
that
just
bastard.
Have the initial, yeah, if you just have the T, the middle initial T in there, then I'm the only one, Ryan T. Husk. It's easy. Or you can just Google the Incredible Husk. That's me, too.
Okay. And you said you're producing?
Yeah, I'm also producing a lot of things, too. So if you have something that you need, somebody out there has a project that they need help producing, or if they just want a little bit of friendly advice on how to do producing or production things or, you know, whatever, I'm available to work on things. I'm available to talk about things or help out or make connections for people if they need good crew people, if they need good actors, I can connect them easily.
That's awesome. Well, we're looking forward to all your projects. I mean, you're living the dream as far as we're concerned. And we're looking forward to, especially Memorial. I'm really looking forward to this because I wanted to see this feature take off. How far along on project are you?
That one is probably the least far along right now. That one is still in development. So that one's going to be a good few months before we shoot the short, and then a few months after that before we do the series. So that one is definitely in the most beginning stages of anything, I'd say. We're not in pre-production yet.
Well, we look forward to seeing you in all your projects, and hopefully I'll see you when the fever breaks on the red carpet when it comes out very, very soon. Ryan T. Husk, thank you very much for joining us on this great Sunday. Have yourself a great weekend.
Hey, thanks very much, Steve. I'll talk to you next time.
Thanks, sir. Bye-bye. All right, boys, we got the Ryan T. Husk there. That was a fantastic interview. He brought the inner geek in all of us, I believe. If you're a Battlestar Galactica fan, I think you're going crazy. If you're a Firefly fan, I think you're going nuts as well because you want him to go watch it. Please, Ryan, go watch it and let us know. The next guest we're going to have on is David Haverty. We're going to take a small little break. I hope you like reggae. I love reggae. Well, I believe I found a couple people who did not like reggae. I just talked to a couple people who definitely hate reggae. So, but I don't. I love it. Let's welcome the fantastic, the always incredible, David Habit.
Hello.
Hi, sir. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
We get very good. We got a rocking show. We have a big group listening to our show right now. Thank you, everybody, for listening in today. David Haverty, I've been wanting to have you on for a very long time, ever since I saw that you had a werewolf musical going on. I wanted to know everything about that. It's very difficult to see original things these days. It's very difficult to see things that come straight out of people's minds and then go straight to maybe the Playhouse. Can you tell us about how your career began?
For me, it started off when I was 10 years old. Looked for stuff to do and got into musicals. My mom, I failed at baseball. I couldn't run around the bags without looking like I was dancing. So I got made fun of. I'm like, okay, this isn't for me. I don't know what I want to do. My mom put me in some theater. That's it. I fell in love with theater after that and acting. And someone said, hey, you're good at this. I was like, wow, somebody's not making fun of me for trying to do something. I think I'm going to keep trying to see if I can do more of this. Then ended up going to high school, majoring in musical theater at a magnet program in Florida. And then from there went on to theater projects, working with, legends, Anne Reinke, Gwen Verd, and Ben Vereen. And then went to college in New York, went to Marymount, Manhattan. And did that for 4 years, went to New York, did what I could there for musicals and culture and try to tap in what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And then, the city is a rough city to live in. So I thought I'd try to make a step out in L.A. I visited out here for 1 week. I was having a Corona by a pool. I was like, whoa, this is where I'm moving. Literally 2 months later, maybe a month later, I moved out of New York, went back to Florida, got stuck there for 2 years, did some dinner theater, did about, four or five musicals, and then I moved my butt out here. I've been out here for 8 years now. And, I just connected into the theater world out here.
Well, your IMDb, as we were looking for it earlier, because it was kind of difficult to find for a couple of seconds there, but yeah. I mean, it's incredible when I talk to people and you look at all the different related fields that you're into in the producing, directing, right, cinematography, camera and electrical department, editing. Now, I always see that in people who've done summer stock or have done plays or musicals. Do you find that is part of the acting scheme, that if you do have that background, you will be able to do a lot of jobs opposed to just going straight to film?
I think when you do theater, I think in smaller areas, I guess mainly when you're in education, you're not just out there learning how to act and be in front of the camera and do your one craft. You are put into a lot of different classes. You're put into stage craft. You're put into stage makeup. Because when you go backstage in a theater, you have to put on your makeup every single night by yourself. Because we don't have a bunch of makeup artists putting the makeup on for us. So we have to learn how to do it. And sometimes you start to learn techniques and crafts yourself. So through that, I think I've gathered a pretty good knowledge of makeup. And then just the love for light, because you're in the theater and you constantly have these lights going on and off every single scene. They're very active in the production. You have to know when they're happening. And if that light doesn't go off at a particular time, it ruins the moment. And I think from that and from theater, where you have to, you're creating your own edits when you're on stage. You don't have anybody controlling the comedic timing if you flub the line or whatever. So you get to know, I think that's where I found my rhythm as an editor, how to edit yourself and maintain beats and rhythms. And you know when something's not moving fast or something's not funny, and you adjust. Now, if that's something I think most actors get from theater, I don't think so. I think some people just have to want to do all those different aspects of the production and entertainment. And I love all aspects of entertainment. So obviously you can tell from my IMDb where you can actually see what gets credited, what doesn't get credited. There's also all around, like grip, electric. So I do lighting as well on my own productions. Yeah.
Right. I would think that in an actor's point of view or a director's point of view, the nightmare of being part of a product would be acting, singing, blocking, directing, writing, working with people. I would say that would probably be, a lot of actors and writers have done plays in college years and what have you, but doing this like the Werewolves of Hollywood Boulevard, that mm-hmm. seemed extremely difficult. Did you have that mindset going into it, or did you just kind of go, I'm just going to throw this out of the park?
Well, what's great is in the last 3 years, I've connected with an artist, composer, writer, singer, actor himself, Michael Shaw Fisher. Michael Shaw Fisher pulled me into a musical 3 years ago called Doomsday Cabaret because his orca, he had a person who was doing his music direction, Michael Tioli. I'd worked with Michael Tioli a year before that doing a musical of his called Carnival, which is actually very H.G. Lovecraft, about a shoggoth kind of thing that visits a carnival, and I was the hair covered. And he gave me a lot of rock, high-pitched solos and a lot of really, really rock kind of style. So when Doomsday came up, they lost an actor literally a day before their first rehearsal. Kill has told Michael Shaw Fisher, hey, I got this guy. He can do some rock stuff. Let's put him in. And after Michael Shaw Fisher and I worked together on Doomsday, we've been inseparable for 3 years. And literally during Doomsday Cabaret, he's like, David, I'm going to write a musical for you. I was like, oh, okay, thanks, dude. I really appreciate that. That's really nice of you. You know, I like my voice too, but somebody that's going to write a musical, I can't even write a play or write a book myself, or I write 3 poems and I'm done. I'm like, oh, but this guy can sit down in a room and write a play. He wrote Doomsday Cabaret in 5 days. And that musical ended up going on
really?
To get an Ovation nomination for Best Music and Lyrics, and it was his first musical he ever wrote. So this guy's talented. That's all I can tell you. So when he tells me,
that's
hey,
fantastic.
David, I want to write a musical for
you.
You
play Kurt.
Hmm?
You play Kurt the lead in this, right?
Yeah, Kurt, yeah. That was one of the leads. The beautiful thing about Doomsday was that it was an ensemble, truly an ensemble. And everyone stays on stage the whole time. It's like people are doing this seminar about the end of the world, except it's supposedly on the last night of the world during, I think it was December 21st, 2012 was when that whole end of the world thing was happening in 2012, right? So he wrote a musical based on the last day of the world that we all were here trying to prove who was going to be right. And really, in the end, it doesn't matter if it did end. We all were just trying to be right. My character didn't care. He just was a guy who liked to burn things on fire. He was the arsonist from the Noho Arsonist character that he based it off of. Mm-hmm. So Michael then finally came up with the Werewolf musical like 2 years later. What's that?
Really? So you came up with that musical 2 years later. Now, there aren't a lot of musicals that are like that. I mean, there are your kitschy, you know, plays out there or musicals out there like, you know, Spider-Man, like that, you know.
Right.
What did you do differently to not make it like, you know, I don't know, Genesis, you know, kitschy. I don't know what other word to use except for just easy. What did you do differently?
Well, I really helped Michael as much as I could. I wasn't even considered a producer. I tend to put my hands in a lot of things that I'm involved with to where I act as a producer because I just want to make sure we're creating the best product if we're putting our time into it. And I try not to step on toes. Sometimes I do. Some people appreciate it. Most people don't. But with Michael, he understands my intention. So what Michael wanted to do with this show is he didn't want to do, you know, a Twilight werewolf musical, you know, just glorifying, hey, we're, you know, this love triangle between these mythological creatures. He actually based these off of historical people in the past that have been tried, convicted, and executed for claiming to be werewolves and have actually had serial killings or murders that they were accused of.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, that totally makes sense. It's bothering my mind. You know, it's very interesting. I saw Phantom of the Opera when I was 15 years old, and it was the first time I ever felt like I could be a writer. Not the musical part, but the play part. So I've always been very interested in people who take this perspective on life. Because it's incredibly difficult and also not greatly appreciated a lot of times by people of today. Because they don't understand how it all began with, you know, Mozart, Beethoven, and you go into the plays of and the operas of today that we all love. People love things like Moulin Rouge and what have you, but musicals and what have you, it's kind of it's a tough play today. How do you find that the audience is receiving your work these days, especially with rock musicals, rock opera?
Right. Today, with musicals, I don't want to insult the current audience. Audiences are different everywhere you go. New York audiences are different. They're a lot harder on you than if you were in the middle, you know, Mideast, or if you're doing summer stock, or if you're in L.A. L.A. audiences, I think, are more open to the off-the-wall kind of absurd approach to musicals. And once you get to New York, you got a lot of Disney. You got things that either have already been a movie before or based on a book. They don't want to open up their mind to listen too hard, to follow a story they've never heard.
Right.
Now, I don't think that's the audience's fault. I think that they've been somewhat fed easier concepts and go and listen to a fun musical and see singing and dancing and things like that. When you see shows that have never been produced before, they're critical in the sense that, oh, it's the story, oh, it's because the music was too loud, and it's because it's just kind of like with new media. We're now used to short bursts of information, and our attention spans are slower, are faster. They want to go to the next thing as soon as possible. So when we did this musical, we're doing it in the Fringe, which means it's a collection of work during a 2 to 3 week period called the Hollywood Fringe Festival. And there's Edinburgh, there's New York Fringe Festival, there's Fringe Festivals all over the place now. And what happens is there's six shows within one theater space every day, so you want to get the production moving and out so the next show can come in, and you don't want a whole audience there for 2.5 hours because they'll look at your show and go, well, I got two other shows I could see within that time frame, so let's go see the short show that's only 90 minutes or the hour show. And with that concept, Michael Shaw Fisher knew that, okay, when he produces and writes shows, he writes them in the shorter format, and then if it does get picked up and somebody does want to further the longer production to a larger venue, a longer run, maybe try to go do an off-Broadway New York run, then he would extend the piece to be a longer format because audiences region want to get in and get out. And so with the feedback we got on this musical, we actually got feedback that we rushed it too quickly because this is a jam-packed full of information, and it isn't just a love story where a guy sees a girl in a crowded room and they fall in love and there's conflict to get each other to love each other, kind of like West Side Story, which, you know, is a great musical, don't get me wrong, but that formula has been used so often that that's what people are expecting. So when you just get a guy that's coming in and has a conflict and he's visited by these werewolves through premonitions and visions and trying to find out the point as to why he's being visited by these people, it causes people to get frustrated because they want more information, but then they don't, it's a catch-22. You want them in the seats, but then once they're there, they want more. But they are not going to get in the seats if they see it's a 2.5 hour show or a 2 hour show. Does that make sense?
No, that totally makes sense. So that's where you're going.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So to get people to really absorb the storylines and so forth like that, we want them to do research afterwards, and maybe we'll get a longer run in the future. But yeah, right now they're not too receptive on original work as much as we'd like them to, unless it's completely sugar-coated and not too deep of concepts, like just the discrimination or bullying, and then you get over the bully. That's really as far as I think the audiences right now want to go. Any deeper than that, they start to question the writer instead of questioning their own abilities to retain and absorb the content. That's pretty much right.
So you're finding that audiences nowadays, at the very least, want shorter projects than longer projects.
Right.
And that's the way you keep
it. Yeah.
And do you find the subject matter itself is changing as well? Whereas if we look at maybe the Victorian days, maybe love and the absence of love would be their main attractor. What would be the main attractor of musicals and plays today that you see a lot of?
It's kind of like, I think, the Harry Potter formula, where you have an underdog, or like Belle from Beauty and the Beast, or you have somebody who's like Shrek, all these different Disney storylines. Disney is a very, you know, they stick by a formula where it's the outcast supposed to be a princess and isn't recognized for their beauty, and then they overcome everybody's opinions of them, and then they get what they want, and then we get to see them glory in their glory, because the audience and people in general are downtrodden. That's why they go to the theater. That's why we have entertainment. That's why we are entertainers, is to help people get distracted from bring them down and the things of the regular daily life that they have to go through. And
right.
And so when shows remind them of their own plight, it causes discourse with their feelings about the show, whether or not it was a good show. So, for instance, I just watched, last two nights went to go see Streetcar Named Desire last night, and I saw The Cherry Orchard the night before that. And these two plays were written back, 50 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yes.
And what's happening, that was 75 years ago. And at that time, people were interested in the way that people spoke to each other and the necessity for relationships and the desire that what they can get is through another person's acceptance of them despite their flaws. And that was enough for audiences then just to see this interaction. It was like they're soap operas. But now, through these shows, they have to be classics to get an audience to sit down and then absorb a new show. People, for Streetcar, most of these people have already seen the movie. So it's almost like they've already got
right.
footnotes on what's going on and what to expect, and then they're comparing them to Marlon Brando's performance or whatever, and they're not sitting to see two people wallowing in a sweaty New Orleans, neighborhood just over their sister visiting that has mental problems and how they're passionately
right.
in love with each other. That's it. That's the only concept in that show. But it's beautiful to hear the interaction and the way that they get through and also a lot of their addictions to each other's attention and love. And that was enough. Nowadays, I don't think if it's a new work, you'll be able to get that kind of audience to sit through a 2.5-hour show without going, oh, that was just drawn out and I've never heard this, this wording. Of course, not everybody's Tennessee Williams to be able
right.
to have a wordsmith to be able to use that great dialogue. But we hope that we will find a new one. We hope that a playwright out there will amaze us and not have to go to some sugar-coated storyline.
It's interesting that Samuel Clemens said that a classic is a book that everybody knows but nobody reads. And
right.
when I look at plays and musicals and what have you, it feels the same way to me. Because mm-hmm. some people have never seen A Streetcar Named Desire, and Vivian
right.
Leigh is one of my favorite actresses of all time. And if you've never seen A Streetcar Named Desire, shame on you. Shame on
right.
you. These are some of the greatest performances,
right.
some of the greatest actors of all time. I
right.
remember when somebody said they've never seen The Godfather. I felt
right.
like somebody called my father a bad name. I looked at him like, are you out of your mind?
Right.
There are things that are good out there that you should probably contribute to and watch and
right.
see. Well, I don't feel compelled. You feel compelled to watch a crappy show like General Hospital, like one episode
right.
of like this crappy little, but you don't want to watch like six hours. Six great hours of a great movie. It's incredible to me.
But that's
like I wanted
to
share
that. TV has become like music. It's been a background to people's lives, and they're like, it's like reality television. They just want to see a quick thing. Oh, this drama, but true, slow, intensity.
I'm surprised they haven't come up with a show of like make a play on the day and let's see it happen like on Broadway. I've been
right.
very surprised. You see Project Runway, you see America's Next Top Model, you see Master Chef. I want to see a master playwriter or a master creator, where you see the Webbers of the world.
Right.
Come on. Go ahead.
Well, what's great is they've been reintroduced, obviously, in the last 3 or 4 years. They've been reintroducing musicals to major blockbuster movies. Which Chicago
right.
was 10 years ago, I think. I don't even know how long ago that
yeah.
was, but that was
yeah.
for me. As a musical, with the musicals in my background and my intention to be in L.A. to do film and television and now becoming a producer and shooting my own work and all that kind of stuff, that to see musicals coming back into the streamline of film and major motion
right.
pictures was amazing. And to know, how those sort of things are happening. So when they brought the most recent television show in Glee also has really helped, even though they got into a lot of deep issues and deep-rooted issues on, Fame, which was back in the 1970s, which was a little bit more raw. Glee has gone a little bit more
right.
sugar-coated. You meet the, Vampire Diaries kind of feel and all these very teenage age ranges. But I do believe that that's reintroducing kids that age about musicals. And in a way, right. I think I wouldn't be surprised all these Broadway, you know, producers like, hey, let's go produce this musical on television so people will want to come see musicals again and not have to just see a Disney movie on stage. And hopefully there might be an intention like that, but that's just me hoping. I don't know if that's actually true at all. That's just my hope.
Yeah,
that
I agree
some intention. Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. I shut you off. Go ahead. Continue.
No. I just can't tell if there's a breakup with my cell phone. But then there's that TV show Smash that just came on, and it just recently was canceled. But that's all about the Broadway musical process and had a little bit of drama. So I think the next step would be, let's see the reality of actually making that happen, and that would be amazing. I'd love to see
right.
that. There's a lot,
I would
drama,
too. I would...
a lot of drama.
Well, you know, it was funny. You know, I'm out here in Colorado now for a little while.
Oh yeah,
it was very interesting. Yeah, I was going to put on some plays based on Quentin Tarantino's stories, and I was going to put a 4-part play series together that it amalgamated all the series together. And they did that in Hollywood just recently, like 3 months ago. And it was very interesting about, you know, it's what Spielberg says with the creative minds. When you think of a project, if you don't do it, somebody else will.
I just heard that yesterday. E. Emerson made a quote about if you don't, you know, follow the beam of light that flashes across your consciousness, if you don't do it, then soon you'll be applauding somebody else doing it.
There you go.
That's exactly the thing. Yeah. If you feel that light cross you, that means it's somewhere else. And if you don't do it now, you'll be applauding somebody else for following the light that you didn't. So that's pretty much what exactly happened. But with Tarantino's show, that's called For the Record, the Quentin Tarantino piece. A few of my friends have been through that show. I think it just recently closed. That we call a jukebox musical, where, again, you're walking into the room with music you recognize, and there's nothing you need to be open to follow. Just kind of, you know, runs through it. And that's a musical. Is it a play? I think it would be completely different, and also in a different region. So I still say go for it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, I want to go back. You know, something that just I can't let go of. I'm looking back at your childhood, and I'm thinking, did you like plays and musicals when you were a child? And if you did you ever get flack for it? Because I certainly did get flack for it.
Continuously, yes.
Really?
The first musical, which made me fall in love with musicals, was sitting down and watching musicals with my mother. I used to watch figure skating, ballroom dancing, and that I enjoyed. I didn't like to sit down and watch baseball. I was like, I don't get it. What's going on? This guy sits, okay, then they run. That's really hard to do that, and catching that's hard. But when the music is introduced with story, I was already enveloped. And this was before I even thought of stepping onto the stage. I never even thought I'm going to be an actor. I just was more drawn to that form of entertainment as a child. And when I was 8 or 9, my mother put me into the Florida Boy Choir. And just because she heard me singing really, really loud in church choir with my parents when we were in church. And like, you can sing really loud, David. Okay, you can sing. You're actually on key. I was like, great. And again, I have no after-school activities that I enjoy. She puts me into the Florida Boy Choir. And that was the first step on stage as a singer, a performer. And then the next step was theater. And people around me, I think, had respect for me in silence, because once they all grew up and once they all became adults and teenagers, their respect for me changed.
Right.
But as a child, oh, yeah, I had to avoid them and got picked on a lot. Again, but once I stepped into the theater, that was my group of people. That was my support group. That was my gang. I would, you know, go through the day of getting crap from people and then would go home and be like exactly where I wanted to be. But then gradually through middle school, it turned around. People were asking me where I was going for theater, and teachers were giving me assignments, and then talent shows, and then solos, and then circles of friends all just came from that energy of putting myself out there and embarrassing myself and enjoying it. Because at one point, in the school choir, I played Elvis that popped out of a snowman and sang Blue Christmas. And I remember the kids laughing their butts off, and I smiled right back at them like, you wouldn't do this. I've got more guts than you do. And they, and slightly, no matter how much ridicule I felt at that moment, I knew that they knew that. Does that make sense?
Right.
And,
no.
And that just it fueled me. It fueled me.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you know, they're calling you names. They're saying things behind your back.
Right.
You're doing these things. What pushes you along? And what? And this is what I really want to know. What keeps you from going down that depressive or negative route that a lot of people have a tendency to do, whereas they do listen to the people. Whereas those people, they, you know, if you were to talk to those people that you went to the grade school with, they wouldn't even recognize they did anything wrong. If they did, they'd apologize.
Right.
They'd say, I didn't even know what I was doing. Right? You know what I mean? I mean, it's just the human condition to be cruel sometimes. But if I were a young kid right now and I'm listening to you and I'm going, listen, I want to be like this guy. I want to do something creative. I want to make musicals that are different, that have a certain je ne sais quoi. You can't put your finger on it. What positivity can you tell those kids who are being knocked down by other kids to keep on going forward?
Well, I think if it remains as words, words will always be thrown at you as a child. But if it gets physical, never, ever stand for that and walk away and even run away. Go get homeschooled, get out of that world, and keep going to the groups of places that you can go. You can find theater groups and places where children can perform, or as teenagers, as classes, everywhere you can find your group of people. And when you leave school, you go hang out with them, and you become friends with them, and you create your circle that's, instead of a bunch of people circling around you and picking on you, you create that circle around you of other people that want to do exactly what you're doing, and those voices become louder than the people that want to knock you down because they think you're different, because you have a stronger voice. And then what's great is when you have that strong voice in a majority of your week or wherever you're going, or you hear that applause in the back of your head when somebody's telling you that you're stupid or you're different or you're not normal, think of the back of your head, you're not in the room. And you're going to stay exactly where you are right here, and I'm going somewhere else. I'm moving somewhere else. I got bigger things in my life.
Right.
And even as a child, I felt that. Even as a child, I was like dreaming of New York, not thinking of. I actually thought of New York as a fairy tale that I actually may never actually see in my life because I was unable to fathom that as a child. Like, I'm going to go to see this place. I don't even know if it exists. I've only seen it in photos. But there was this thought in my mind, I'm going to go do that.
Right.
Sometimes these people are going to stay here in this town and go work at the gas station. And I would tell them down in my head, whether or not they became the owner of the gas station and have millions of dollars now and have five children and a beautiful wife, that's not the point. At that moment, that's what I told myself in the back of my head. You're not going anywhere else, but you're going to live here in your mom's house until you're, 30. And I'm going to go struggle somewhere else and maybe hit it big and have a whole new group of friends that are going to accept me, which I did find. Didn't hit it big, but I found a group of people in a circle of friends that have been my support group ever since.
Nice. You know, so what you did is you surrounded yourself around people who are like you to affirm that you're doing the right thing, right?
Right. Thing was, I never knew it existed until I stepped into a theater. With film and television, you go into a room of auditions and you have a bunch of people in that room that feel like your competition. And I think theater is a great place to start before you go into the quote-unquote business of acting, because you recognize those other people as castmates or people that you're going up for a role and you're going to get a role maybe one day down the road. But when you come back into a theater production, you're all on the same team and you're doing different things or working on a scene or you're just doing your craft and you have friends and it's not a competition in class. That's I think the major benefit of class. I'm not an advocate of a long-running just become a student and don't do anything else but go to class. I'm very much about doing and creating. That's why when people say, oh, you dream big, I'm like, no, I'm a doer. I'm not a dreamer, and I'm a creator. So I feel that class in the long run, once you get out of college and if you've been in L.A. for 10 years, I think you should be doing more than you're studying. That's just my personal opinion, both as a teenager or a young adult. That is where you create your long life friends. I have a friend right now. Her name is Jessica Howell. She just went to Cannes and pushed two feature films, and has a web series she's producing. I met her when I was 10 years old in that same children's theater in Florida. She went to New York, and now she's out here, and we hang out every single weekend almost out here in L.A. It's these lifelong friends you create as children that can you know, follow you for the rest of your life. And these are friends that I've had beyond high school, friends that I made. These are people that I met when I was 10. And my friend Lee Markham, currently down in Anaheim. Again, I met him when I was 10 years old in that children's theater, and I'm currently editing his demo reel. But we're just still friends ever since. So I really am an advocate of children's theater for young adults who are looking to find out where they belong, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's the part where I get sad for people is when they don't see the connections between each other. When they don't see that we're all connected, we're all kind of doing the same thing, and you can say anything you want, but you're going to watch my product. We're all going to do these things, and we're all acceptable. It's a very weird world sometimes, because when I was a kid, the musical world and the play world was way different than it is right now, and now it is way more acceptable. I mean, I don't know if you remember as a child, if people went to movies, to TV, it was a graveyard. I mean, your career is over. But nowadays, if you do a play right after a movie, I mean, you just took a break. I mean, just like, I can't even think of his name right now, House of Cards. He went off and did Henry VIII, and he keeps on doing Kevin Spacey. Yeah, Kevin Spacey. You know, he just keeps on doing plays, and he goes back to his movies. He does his TV show, which is basically 12 movies.
Right.
And he goes back and does his plays again. That's amazing to me, and that shows real art.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, because also, I mean, have you been on stage and done a play as an actor?
I have. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know the process, and the once you go on stage, it's in your hands. It's all up to you to tell the story.
Yes.
It's up to you to be in the space. And to be in the shoes of Kevin Spacey, who's probably majority in front of a camera, that's stop and go. That's 3 pages in 12 hours that you're working on that one moment. And you don't get to really feel the journey and feel like you're telling the story and to know the arc of the character. And to get into a play once in a while is a way to get that back into your bones of the journey of an act of the character, and you move from one place to the next. And in 1 hour, 2 hours, you move through all these places. So if you can do that in 2 hours and move through an entire 150, 200-page story, 3 pages and 12 will be simple because you've already done that in 2-3 minutes on stage.
Right.
You know? So I think stage is really important.
You know, I completely agree. And that's one of the reasons why I love talking to people who are in the movie industry as well as in the other fields of media. And movies are not the only darn thing in the world. And there's so many different fields of expression and art. And we need to be a part of it as a group. That's what I love about San Francisco. You walk into San Francisco, you'll see the streets littered with papers of plays that are in people's houses. And also in art houses as well, because they're just constantly doing work, constantly crafting their craft. I really, really enjoy that. We're running out of time, and I just love talking to you. I can talk to you forever. Tell me, what is your next project? What are you working on next? Where can we find you next?
About to direct a regional commercial for a product that a really weird story connected to the producer, because I edited a demo reel 2 years ago. And he's an actor, but now he's a marketing director. So he hired me as a director for this product that he's now marketing. And working on small promos for a fitness trainer that, he needs a video for his website. So I'm going to help push his video like Under Armour, give it kind of high-paced thing. So I'm going to shoot and direct it and edit it. But as an actor, currently I'm actually avoiding a lot of theater right now because I really have not been able to get my stuff together. And I got to look for the paying gigs, and I picked up editing because I wanted to edit my own demo reel as an actor, and then started editing and have got clients now to take care of. But I do have aspirations to be heading to New York for an audition in a few months for a musical that I know a producer that's going to hopefully call me out there for a show.
I would. I've been following you for a while now. Well, I've been following your career for a while now. You're a great personality. You're very affable. You definitely have the presence of somebody we need out there in the acting sphere. And I really enjoyed what I've watched from what you've done. How can we find you? How can we find the great David Haverty?
Well, of course, like most actors should do, DavidHaverty.com. That's spelled on the title of this link, so you can copy and paste it pretty easily. I have a link to a lot of my work there. But as a creator, I've created a launchpad website for everything I do called Odd Dog Pictures. I think of myself as, like, again, like being an appcast, but I'm a master of many aspects and odd jobs, and Odd Dog kind of just came into its own existence that way. So Odd Dog Production, Odd Dog Pictures, .com, and that launches you to my editing, to I produce demo reels for actors, to my performance as an actor, and my editing, because a music video that I edited and shot for an artist called Kovas, that's K as in, you know, Kim, K-O-V-A-S,
yes.
If you go to iamkovas.com, a music video that I produced, shot, and edited will be coming out on the 9th, called Hollywood.
Nice.
It's actually a short film. He's going back to the old hip-hop ages where you'd have a little short film before for the actual music video.
Yeah.
So the whole thing is about 11 to 12 minutes. Starts with a six-minute short film. We go into the musical. We stop it. We start it. We stop it. It's pretty funny. We got some people from UCB that are involved. And then I shot another musical video of his that's going to be hopefully closely following. But he's very smart in the way that he does his marketing. So things will drop a little bit here. You know, drops little crumbs for his, you know, his fans so they can see them. But the next two music videos that he's dropping, I shot and edited for him. And web series Slightly Dramatic is still available online if you ever want to go look that up. Everything's on the Odd Dog Pictures main page. You can look at the news that I post as to what I'm doing as a producer and editor. And then if you want to see me as an actor, I'll be posting on my website or on Facebook. Add me.
If you go to David Haverty on Facebook, if you go to the About, you can find all the links to his official website, Demo Reel, Reel Editing Company, Twitter, Hollywood Blog, IMDb. You can find everything on his Facebook as well. Haverty, H-A-V-E-R-T-Y. I'm sorry, continue?
Yeah, H-A-V is in Victor, yep. Oh, and also if you're an actor and you're in anywhere in the country, I've been running this Facebook group for the last 3 years, and I've shot a 48-hour film festival out of these group of actors. We've started a group called Action Group where we actually shoot films once a month with these actors that just come up with their own scripts, their own storylines, everything everybody's written for, and we produce a short. Sometimes it gets edited. Sometimes we just give the footage to the actor to use for whatever they want. But it all started from this group called Actors Supporting Actors. So if you want to go check that out on Facebook, as long as you know somebody that's in the group or you post that you're an actor or your profile photo, I make sure that everyone is somewhat related to somebody in the group. And we have almost 3,000 members in that group right now. So hopefully if you need a little support group, ask questions about agents, go in there. If you need to look for an apartment in L.A. and you want to meet people, go have a drink.
David Haverty, you're awesome. I love having you as a guest. You're exactly the way I thought you would be, which is hilarious to me. That rarely
happens. I've never actually really talked before this. I'm like, okay, David, slow down. I'm usually a fast talker, and I've obviously probably went a mile a minute. Hopefully everyone could follow me. But to actually talk about yourself when you're actually told to talk about yourself is nerve-wracking.
Right.
But, you know, in L.A., you're always trying to talk and sell yourself, and I'm like, well, we actually have to do it now. Goodness gracious.
People are pretty good about selling themselves. You're fantastic. You did a great job. You know, the one thing I really wanted to hear was positive notes from you, and I heard a lot of them. The great David Haverty, thank you so much for joining us today. I know that we've been talking back and forth for months to get you on the show, and I'm so glad we got you on today. Thank you so much for being on tonight, and have yourself a great weekend. Everybody, the great David Haverty, have a great weekend, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, man. Take care.
Thanks, sir. All right, boys and girls, that was a great show. Oh, the music's playing. We had Ryan T. Husk on here, the great Ryan T. Husk. Great guy. Star Trek world, Battlestar Galactic world, battling against each other in his world. He's going to play Wesley Crusher's father in a Star Trek Memorial. I can't wait to see that. What a great guy. What a great conversation. Please, please, please go watch Firefly. David Haverty, what a great guy. Funny, likable, affable. I like that guy a lot. Please look for these guys on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. People go to Instagram these days and make a whole thread of conversations. Incredible. Go to his Facebook page. Go to everything you can. Look this guy up and appreciate their work. They're working really hard. When the Fever Breaks, made by Tymaine Clay. Look it up. You really enjoy it. Coming out soon. I had the great honor of producing that movie, and I'm very proud. To all of you out there, thank you very much for listening today. Charles Carpenter, I hope you're having a great day. God bless you for walking for your father today, for Alzheimer's relief. We love you, and we hope you're having a great day. Good day to all of you all as well. Remember, you're all very special. I know I say that every week, but it's true. You're very special. This world would not be the same without you. Stay positive. Listen to the people who I have on the show. Stay positive. Keep on going for your dream. Because if you don't, somebody else will. And you know they will. You have what you have. You have something to offer the world and offer it. Everybody, have yourself a great weekend. God bless you. I'm your host, Steve Pisa, for Cinemafiles Radio. I'll see you next week when we have another great guest. Cheers.